Hello, and welcome to this podcast from Consider This. Please let me know what you think and tell others about us on social media. This podcast was originally broadcast live on Northumberland 89.7 FM. You can hear this show live every Friday at noon. Thank you for downloading this program, and I hope you enjoy it. Hello, I'm Robert Washburn, and welcome to Consider This Northumberland, a current affairs program dedicated to the issues facing our community. We talk to the people on the front lines and those behind the scenes who make a difference in your life in Northumberland County. So I'm asking you, the listener, to take some time out of your busy day to consider this. While most of us are fretting about getting a vaccine to stem the pandemic, some people in Northumberland are focusing their attention on other global concerns, like climate change. This week's show looks at two initiatives taking place locally around climate change. The first is a group called Blue Dot Northumberland. It is a chapter of a national movement fighting climate change. Members of this group recently met with Northumberland Peterborough South MP Philip Lawrence. It prepared a report to Lawrence in response to a federal plan called Healthy Environment, Healthy Economy. It is a national plan to create green jobs and an environmentally sustainable economy in the future. It would impact everything from how you heat your home to how farmers do business. You'll hear their ideas and recommendations from a Northumberland perspective. Here is my interview with Blue Dot Northumberland. I'm so pleased to have with me today Steve Lapp and Bob Garthson. Both are volunteers with Blue Dot Northumberland. Welcome to Consider This.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So who or what is Blue Dot Northumberland? Can you start there?
Blue Dot Northumberland is a group of volunteers interested in environmental issues. And the Blue Dot movement has come out of the David Suzuki Foundation as a movement to initially enshrine the right to a clean environment into the Canadian Constitution was one of the sort of main thrusts. But we've really taken up interest in environmental issues in a number of areas, from agriculture at the local level to climate change at the global level and many things in between. So we as a group sort of decide what issues we're interested in, and then we find the right volunteers to pursue those interests.
Now, I know this is a national group. Can you tell me the history of the local group here in Northumberland?
Well, probably Faye McFarland is the one best asked that question for, or question two. So I'm going to be unnecessarily vague, I'm afraid, Bob, but I think it's about 4 to 5 years old.
That's correct. Faye had,
yeah, so Bob, maybe if you want to maybe speak to that in more detail.
Well, it's about 4 or 5 years old. It also connected locally with the Council of Canadians, and there were two branches, Blue Dot, and the other group deals with trade and economic issues. Now, I'm the liaison between both groups, so that's part of my role, and it's become advocates for local issues that impact negatively on the environment, and it's joined other initiatives that are, some of them, international, worldwide, like the Green New Deal and other issues related to that. So it's got a history of advocacy, and it's done a number of presentations to the local municipal councils and county council on issues ranging from clean water to using chemicals in spray programs and farming to many other issues. That's a brief summary.
How many members do you have?
Well, we had the last meeting we had before COVID, we actually had a meeting at my farm, and there were about 30 people. I think there's about 80 people on the network. Steve, is that
But right, and during COVID, the numbers have fluctuated hugely, you know, but we're down to more sort of double-digit numbers now, and hopefully it'll grow again once we can meet in person.
I understand that you had a meeting with Northumberland Peterborough South MP Philip Lawrence recently. Can you tell me what that meeting was about?
Sure. Well, the meeting was about a report recently published by the federal government called the Healthy Environment, Healthy Economy. And the report is about how Canada can tackle our greenhouse gas emissions in sort of a holistic way. So right from, you know, the smaller industries to homes, to agricultural practices, to large industry. And the plan really lays out how Canada can work towards a 2030 goal of a 30% reduction 30% reduction in greenhouse gases. And we wanted to talk to Philip about the ways that the actions in that report can be beneficial for the people in his riding in terms of jobs and new employment and construction and renovation. So we had prepared a document which we sent to him, several pages long, that outlined in the various sectors where there would be actions locally that come out of these federal initiatives to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And we wanted to share our ideas with him on how that can be of benefit to the people in this riding.
So can you give us a brief summary of some of those recommendations that you made and how they would impact us locally? Maybe, Bob, would you give us a couple?
Well, I think Steve should do that, but I'll come back to agriculture, if that's okay with you, Rob. He can go through. You're going to go through the general document, and just may I say before I begin this, we're looking at the need for issues like training, local funding for innovation and change, and cooperation across all sectors. Those are the three principles, I think, Steve.
Yeah. I will let Bob follow up after what I speak to, but let Bob follow up with agriculture. But the other sectors are buildings. So obviously the heating of buildings and the cooling of buildings has an impact on our environment with the fuel burned. And then there's a heavy industry, of which we have a little bit in the area, and there's light industry. There's also waste, which is typically the greenhouse gas impact of waste is either through methane production of organic materials that get buried or from the burning of waste streams. And then transportation, which is, of course, a big one and involves all our cars and trucks and other vehicles. So within each of those sectors, there are a number of sort of approaches that can be taken to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And we presented to Philip sort of what those approaches are and the actions that we feel he can advocate that would help us achieve the emissions and also create opportunities in the businesses in our riding.
Before we get on to the agriculture, I'd just like to go back a bit and talk about some of what you just alluded to. One of your suggestions in your report is a major retrofit of existing buildings from natural gas, oil, or propane to heat pump technology. Now, how realistic is that considering how much it would cost to homeowners or municipalities or landlords, industry?
Sure. Well, I guess, you know, in terms of saying how realistic something is, the thing we need to look at is how essential is the transition. So if we follow the science of climate change and the need to reduce emissions, we end up with, you know, it being essential to reduce emissions. And then the question is, you know, what's the cost-effective way to do that? Is it necessarily cheaper? Not always, but is it necessary? Yes. So when we look at buildings, we look typically, obviously, in rural areas, there's lots of buildings heated by propane and oil, and also pure resistance electric heating. And the economics for switching those buildings to heat pumps, which would generally also involve probably an energy audit to determine whether the building should be improved in its overall heat efficiency first, the economics are quite good for those transitions because people are generally, or businesses are going to save money with the transition in the long run, and it'll pay off the equipment. In terms of houses on natural gas, which are going to be most of the ones in the towns and other smaller communities that have natural gas, those transitions are more difficult from a purely economic perspective. But, you know, all furnaces eventually wear out. And when they need to be replaced, if the regulations and incentives and tax benefits encourage us to replace them with heat pumps, then the cost impact isn't very significant. And in fact, in the future, maybe it's neutral even.
Now, Bob, I'd like to talk to you about the impact on agriculture. Would you mind explaining some of the proposals in the report you gave to Philip Lawrence around agriculture?
Sure. And I want to, can I put it in just a brief context? I recognize almost universally now that we're in a climate emergency. And I don't know whether you're familiar with Seth Klein, but he's an excellent writer and author. He's written a book called The Good War. And he compares what needs to be done now with how Canada prepared for World War II at a much greater cost, a much higher ratio GDP. So, yes, there are costs involved, but the longer we wait to take action, and I think that's one of the points we made to Philip, the longer we take, the more it's going to cost. And in fact, the jobs and the sustainability and the air that would be involved in dealing with issues like trees and the access to local food security are essential no matter what the economy looks like. And now more and more have to go in that direction. So that means reform. And yes, there does need to be funding and tax reform to keep smaller scale GHG intensive farms viable, access to low cost capital to finance both large and small scale farmers to implement the changes to low carbon practices, and championing programs to plant trees and restore damaged habitat to enhance carbon uptake and to in fact purify our air. And I worked on an area, I don't know whether you're familiar with agroecology, which encompasses all these and is the official position in the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations and a number of organizations around the world. And it combines all of the concepts we're talking about into how we can provide people with secure, healthy food and maintain our ecosystems so that they can produce into the future. That's essentially the focus that we provided with to MP Lawrence.
But I wonder just how many farmers did you talk to in putting together those proposals? Local farmers.
I am a farmer. I've been a farmer for over 60 years, an ecological farmer. I was on the Agricultural Advisory Committee to the county and on the Food Policy Council for the county. So over many years, I've talked about these issues. One of the critical problems is, as I said, low farmers do not get any tax incentives, and all farmers at all levels are usually cash strapped if, in fact, they're practicing locally. So it's been difficult for them to stay in business. And in fact, many, many young people, even though they have the opportunity to inherit farms, have decided not to do so because of the impediments. And we know from the experience we've had with the pandemic, we can go from having things being okay to all of a sudden we don't have enough of the essentials that we need. So I've spoken to the agricultural officer at the county. I'm in communications with farm organizations, both locally and across the country, and we're working on another project called Expanding Ontario's Green Belt, which is going on right now, and we're going to be communicating with those people as well. So groups that range from the Ecological Farmers of Ontario, which I was on the board years ago, National Farmers Union, we have someone in our group that's going to be talking to the Ontario Federation of Agriculture, and we're trying to reach out to all those groups to look at a common approach to this emergency that in fact will actually accomplish what we set out to accomplish.
In your remarks, it was really clear to me that, you know, the intention's really, really good. But as you said, I mean, farmers are really struggling, especially after COVID. But even before then, there were so many regulations. A lot of them are on the brink of not being able to stay in business. Things fluctuate so badly. I mean, I've interviewed farmers, and they'll tell you in a heartbeat just how hard it is. How do you see our path forward then? What kinds of investment are we looking at? What kinds of policies? Because it sounds to me like if it's not handled well, this could just make it 10 times worse for the average farmer.
If there's implementation from the top down, without consultation, without guarantees of education, training, financial support for new innovations and new changes that have to happen, it will be a disaster. And in fact, only the wealthiest of the organizations will survive. In fact, that is definitely a critical question. Farmers have had reduced capacity to make change for many, many years. When I was a teacher of environmental studies, we used to play a game called the farm game, where students learned about how risky investments were in agriculture. So this is a long-standing issue, and we really need a new generation of farmers to take over, and the incentives are not there now, and the average farmer, I'm 75, the average farmer is past retirement age if you look at other sectors. So there has to be upfront the commitment to provide the supports for change. That's absolutely essential. And again, that was done during World War II when there we were in emergency mode. We are not in emergency mode. The Seth Klein points out, in an emergency, you have to spend what it takes to win. You have to create a new economy and institutions like the Crown corporations that were created then. You have to move from voluntary, if you want to do this, do it, to mandatory in some cases, and you have to tell the truth to everybody. Those principles apply to what we're dealing with here.
So when did you meet with Philip Lawrence, Steve?
I believe it was March 16th.
And what kind of a reception did you receive?
We've been completely impressed working with Philip on these issues. He's listened very clearly. He's been very attentive in terms of the details and asking questions. And we feel that, you know, in principle, he says he supports many of these issues. So we've found it to be a very productive dialogue. And he's asked us to, you know, continue helping him find, the way forward on these challenging aspects of transitioning to a low carbon economy.
He's asked me to consult on agriculture with him. I think one of the issues, as you probably know, is that the Conservative Party has not set their feet in terms of what direction they're going to go in. And even at the convention, there was a lot of dispute and debate. I think people like Lawrence are trying to make some of the issues we're talking about part of the Conservative platform, just as other parties are. And we're in communication with all political parties around these issues. So, you know, he has to deal with his own party in terms of what they're going to decide on. And there's a lot of pressure from wings of the party not to do what we were talking to him about.
Okay, so I appreciate very much the way you both have talked about this, and it makes some sense. But if I'm listening to this and I'm trying to get my head around it, I'm just an everyday kind of person. You guys talk on huge scales, huge numbers. You talk about spending money, and right now I'm in the middle of COVID, and you know I might not even have a job or know what my future is about. You know, I'm worried right now about a vaccine more than I am about climate change.
Yeah.
So when I hear all of this stuff, it just seems so global and so big and so huge. I haven't heard a lot about what we can do here in Northumberland. Can you bring this down and make this real? And what can I do if I'm listening to this in the next week, the next month, the next 6 months, to really make a substantial difference and communicate and feel part of it, rather than having this sense that it's such a huge problem and we've got to spend huge amounts of money and we've got to transform all of agriculture and we've got to go retrofit every home. I mean, all of that, maybe it's true and maybe it needs to be done, but it just sounds so huge.
No, you're absolutely right. And that's one of the reasons why we're looking, for example, with the other committee on the Greenbelt issues. And certainly we would be prepared to speak to what you're talking about, whether you get a future program where people can ask questions or whether you want to have a set of questions. You know, we can do that. We're beginning the process of trying to pull together information that is scientifically credible from wherever it's sourced, because these are global issues, as you know, with air and water. And with the energy issue, but we are certainly working to find information and to share information wherever we can find it that applies to the local situation. We do believe that there are a number of jobs that will be created, and if we act the way we need to act, and that there'll be a number of jobs that are lost if we don't. And then there's another, a whole a whole number of other issues that go around that. So it's not a question of leaving people alone to find the money to do it, but providing education, information, materials, tax incentives, jobs, so that people can do it.
Okay, so
we're all in that situation. We're in the same situation.
I want to bring it even more. Can you give me one or two things that if I'm listening to this, I can start doing today, or something that I should be considering doing today that I can do that's concrete that goes towards your goals?
Sure. So let me just take a little bit of a step back from the immediacy of that question, Robert. I've been around this business of sort of clean energy for 30 plus years, and did for the longest time believe, you know, that it was up to sort of the individual to make the right decision to move forward. And certainly, you know, many people have, with getting light bulbs or buying a more efficient car, those kind of things, or maybe adding some insulation to their house. But what we're talking about now is like a deep, deep change where, you know, you take your house to a completely different heating system, for example. And some people have the resources and the wherewithal. Maybe they have more time, they're retired, to do that. But you're absolutely right. A lot of people are just, you know, getting their kids up in the morning, getting the lunches made. Maybe they're not going to school at the moment, but they hopefully will be soon. And they're not interested in going into the minutiae of figuring out how to change their house to a heat pump. And that's where, you know, the government, both federal and provincial, have to find a way to help people make these big decisions. And it means things like a phone number that you can call where you get an energy audit for $250. And the energy audit tells you the 10 local contractors that are approved to install heat pumps. And you go get some quotes and you maybe get a low interest loan or a tax break or some sort of, you know, encouragement to make the change. That's the stage we're at now. Some people can still do it on their own, but a lot of people are going to need to just have an easier way of being able to make these changes. Or if they go to buy a car, they need to know that they can get, you know, an electric car at a similar price, fully warrantied, that there are charging stations for it, and it no longer becomes a research project for them to make these changes.
I know one of the activities that your group has been involved in has been going before municipal councils and getting them to adopt becoming a blue dot municipality. Other than the optics of that, has there been any concrete actions that have been taken by any of the municipalities you've gone before and who have adopted blue dot that have been concrete that have made a difference?
I'm not sure I can connect the dot directly, but I think the fact that the County of Northumberland has hired a climate change and sustainability coordinator, and she's been on contract full-time for the past year and has finished greenhouse gas inventory and has been looking at transportation options and housing, heating retrofit programs that could potentially be implemented in our area. So I think that's certainly one of the concrete indicators of the local political scene being such as someone gets hired specifically to address going to a low carbon economy.
They've also passed motions on water use and on joining the blue dot blue communities, and so there's a number of things that have gone under that title and will continue to. There's also, I think, a commitment to look at the whole issue of waste and recycling. And if you look at, for example, the landfill site in Crammy, which I'm familiar with, truckloads, huge transport truckloads every day go in there with packaged food waste, unopened, crates of fruit and vegetables, canned stuff. Like, we're talking a train load of, over a week or two. And that, in fact, increases the cost for everyone for groceries. And it demonstrates some of the problems with bringing things in on refrigerated vehicles from long distances when, in fact, that refrigeration breaks down. I've been there three times, and I've seen those things there every time.
Gentlemen, I want to thank both of you, Steve Lapp and Bob Garson, for being on my show today. Thank you.
Thank you, Rob.
Thank you, Robert.
It's our pleasure.
That was Steve Lapp and Bob Garson, both volunteers with Blue Dot Northumberland. Thank you for listening to this podcast from Consider This. If you have any comments or would like to suggest a story,
please contact me at considerthisnorthumberland@gmail.com, or you can message me on Facebook at Consider This. If you enjoyed this podcast or are looking for more news and information about Northumberland County, please check out my website at consider-this.ca. That's consider-this.ca. And don't forget to share. And again, thank you for listening and stay tuned for more from Consider This.